How hot is it? Ryoko on her Facebook page writes, "My cats have gone bald and I have grown fur. It's so hot." And Michael writes on our Facebook page, "It's so hot, even the Murdochs are on the cold seat." So at the end of this hour, we're going to take more of your answers to the question, how hot is it? And we're collecting many of them by text message. So if you want to submit a so hot answer via text, just text so hot to 30644, and we'll send you the link to do it. Just text so hot to 30644, and we'll collect these and take your calls on how hot is it too, coming up at the end of this hour. Right now, more and more often, Americans are reaching the end of life in hospice care. It's been praised, rightfully so, as this great option for people with terminal illnesses. Instead of undergoing dramatic medical procedures, they receive pain alleviation and compassion. They're cared for people specifically trained in the business of gently accepting death. But our next guest, Peter Waldman, has reported a story that shows that some hospice programs are admitting patients who are not ready to die. Why? To collect money, more money, from insurance companies. He's written an article on this phenomenon for Bloomberg Businessweek. Peter, thanks for coming on to talk about this.
Good morning.
And I have to say that hospice generally has such a good reputation, I'm surprised to hear of the issue and almost reluctant. I mean, of course, we're going to get the information out. But part of my response internally was, oh, my goodness, I don't want to turn people off to something that has helped so many.
Well, that's a natural and a wise reaction, because hospice, as you described, does have a very effective response to the end of life. Basically, patients who enter hospice get comfort care, they get pain alleviation, they get all kinds of medicines and interventions to make them comfortable. What they don't get is curative care or any aggressive therapies that would address whatever condition they have that's causing their decline. What I discovered in my reporting, which is based on a variety of government investigations as well as plaintiff's lawsuits, and interviews with dozens of hospice patient families and hospice workers, is that there's a flip side, and that is that the business or the industry of hospice has increasingly become a for-profit business. It's now about 55% for-profit in terms of the number of hospices around the country. And whenever something is for-profit, that brings in the profit motive, how you make money on this. And the way in which they make money is by billing Medicare. Medicare is the payer of about 88% of all hospice bills. So you got to find a way to get Medicare to pay. The way Medicare pays is they pay a daily rate, a per diem, regardless of the services and the care provided. So it runs about $150 a day for routine hospice care at home. So for $150 a day, Medicare pays the hospice to essentially come to your house a few times a week. So the incentive for the money-making hospices, or for those who are seeking a profit, is to keep you on hospice as long as possible. The way they do that is they find patients who aren't that sick.
So are patients being counseled into hospice when they're months or even years from death?
That is certainly very high on the list of allegations that the U.S. government and the Justice Department, the Office of the Inspector General of the Health and Human Services Department, and several plaintiffs in private lawsuits have made. They're saying that these for-profit hospices use incentives to encourage and inspire their employees, their sales representatives, to find all kinds of ways to get patients into hospice quickly and early. They still need two doctor's signatures, according to federal law, to certify that the individual has a prognosis of 6 months or less to live.
And we should emphasize that. That's the usual standard for entering hospice care, I guess, whether it's either home hospice or in a facility, that you are believed to have 6 months or less to live, correct?
Correct, and that must be certified by your attending doctor, which is the individual patient's doctor, as well as the doctor employed by the hospice company. So there's two signatures there. In fact, in practice, in many cases described in the investigations and lawsuits, the attending doctor does not sign for whatever reason. There is an out in the law that says if there is no attending doctor, that person doesn't have to sign. So what you end up with are the doctors who are paid by hospice doing many of the certifications. And the doctors paid by hospice do all of the recertifications, which is you're entitled to hospice care for those 6 months of your prognosis. And if you outlive that, then a doctor must recertify your six-month prognosis every 60 days.
I was recently told by someone of a guy who'd been in a hospice for 2 years. I don't believe that it was a for-profit hospice in that case, but I was certainly surprised to hear the story. Listeners, do you have any stories of people you know living in hospice for surprisingly long periods of time, let's say more than 6 months? And was it good or bad for the patient? Anybody who works in a hospice or in a hospice system, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. On this, for Peter Waldman from Bloomberg Businessweek, who is investigating a kind of insurance scam, Medicare scam, if you want to call it a scam, where people are being counseled into hospice much earlier than before because Medicare pays $150 a day. So obviously they're going to get more money if they have more patients who are healthier, demanding less services. Peter, is this necessarily bad for the patients? Because if they have terminal illnesses at all, and let's say they don't have 6 months to live, let's say they even have 2 years to live, maybe in many of these cases, it's a good place for them to be anyway if they're losing the capacity to live, you know, in their usual homes.
Well, that's a very good question, and that goes to the nature of these patients who are having these very long stays in hospice. 20% of Medicare patients exceed the six-month period, so one out of five hospice patients outlives that. What happens is, to get these long-stay patients, the hospices are targeting non-cancer diagnoses. So the cancer patients generally die fairly quickly. Their prognoses are well understood. They're much more predictable. It's the non-cancer ones, the Alzheimer's patients, the dementia patients. There are also these very amorphous diagnoses that are acceptable called failure to thrive or general debility. And these very kind of open-ended diagnoses tend to attract particularly the for-profit hospices. And those people can live a long time. Now, to address your question, is it good for the patients? It's a very important question because there are a lot of palliative care doctors in this country and hospice doctors and gerontologists who will tell you that we just don't have a support network, particularly an insurance supported network of care for elderly in this country that people can afford and that gets them the kind of care they need, especially for these long, slow, declining patients like Alzheimer's and dementia and whatnot. So hospice has become a sort of safety net for these people. And it is true, while most of them are living at home or in a nursing home, and that's something else we should talk about because nursing homes have become very important in the hospice equation. While most of them are living in a setting like that, they are getting extra eyes, extra hands, extra help during the week to cope with whatever conditions they have. So that's the upside.
The upside. Although, there is there an issue of medical consequences here? Because when you enter hospice, don't you sign away your right to medical treatment because you're declaring yourself terminally ill in a way that you're not going to seek curative treatment? You're only going to seek palliative care or mostly pain relief? Or is it not that black and white?
Well, it is that black and white, and there are two elements. One is that, yes, you're legally signing your away your rights for those kind of what they call curative, or sometimes are called aggressive therapies. So that's one element. Though, remember, you can always revoke hospice. You can say, I don't want it anymore. I'm going to the hospital or I'm going to a doctor or something. But the other element is that the hospice on this per diem system then is responsible for all of your care and your need, in your medical needs, so to speak, so that it, whatever dollar is spent on any kind of therapy comes out of their hide. So they're resistant and, in some respects, rightfully so, to getting you, you know, any kind of extras that could be interpreted as curative. Let me give you an example that was given to me, and I think it happens a lot. A lot of the declining dementia patients, perhaps they're post-stroke, they have other neurological issues, they're certainly dying or, let's say, declining very slowly. They could benefit a great deal from rehabilitative therapies, perhaps speech therapy or some kind of occupational therapy, other kinds of interventions from specialists who would really augment and improve their lives. In many cases, not all, but in many cases, hospice will not provide that. Hmm.
Fumi in West Orange. Fumi, thank you so much for calling.
Hi, Brian. I listen to your show all the time. But what I want, I'm a nurse practitioner, and I see both sides of the coin. I've worked in long-term care facilities, and I've worked for hospice and to do certification visits. These patients are getting care, oftentimes in their own homes, that they otherwise wouldn't have access to because of cost issues or insurance issues. They get a couple of hours each day of an aid. So they may not have quantity of life left, but it's important that we recognize that quality is a very important issue.
Peter, do you want to talk to Fumi?
Sure. I think Fumi raises a very good point and a very knowledgeable one, having worked in the field. There are a couple issues around that. That is true, and I meant to address that a second ago when I said, yes, this is a safety net for many kinds of patients, and they are getting hands and help on a certain level. There is the question of what they're not getting, which I also mentioned. And then there's the question of how the rules are set. The rules are set in such a way that to abide by the Medicare regulations, these patients need to have or should have a prognosis of 6 months or less. There's only so many Medicare dollars to go around, as we're increasingly recognizing in this country. And that's the way the rules are set. Now, I think there is maybe a good argument by Fumi and others that the rules need to change, that all these hospices who are recruiting long-stay patients, knowing really that they're going to outlive 6 months, are servicing the need of the, let's say, the market, if they're for-profits, or the need of the patients also. So, and that it's the rules that should be rewritten. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of discussion about that in the new healthcare reform law to revise how hospices are reimbursed.
All right, Fumi, thank you for that, and please call us again. Lena in Newark, you're on WNYC. And Lena, you're a hospice medical director?
Yes, I am a hospice medical director. It's a nonprofit which I work for. And the first thing I want to say is we who in the hospice community are aware that there are some for-profit hospices out there where it is becoming a business. And a lot of times, these are not Medicare certified, so they can't really bill Medicare. They're kind of out of network for Medicare, so Medicare will pay them, but it's a different route of payment for them.
Mm-hmm.
We do warn a lot of our internal medicine colleagues about referring to these hospices because we do see some abuse there. But I just wanted to make a comment on the issue of the prognosis. We are very strict with Medicare requirements. So when we enroll a patient, we have, with a certain certain degree of certainty and an understanding that that patient is not going to survive more than 6 months. With the oncology patients, that is 99% of the time happens. That is because our oncologists in this, you know, in our environment, in our culture, are very aggressive. By the time the patient is in hospice, they've had the chemo and the radiation and all that other stuff, and most of the time they do die within 3 to 6 months. The cardiac patients, the end-stage cardiac, the end-stage pulmonary disease, and the end-stage Alzheimer's disease, our experience is once we stop aggressive care, those patients will live longer with a better quality of life. In a lot of times, the interventions which we are doing, we're putting them in the hospital, they're getting, you know, if they're not on hospice, they're being hospitalized, they're getting hospital-acquired infections, they're being intubated, they're getting cardiac procedures and lung procedures, and that is what shortens their period of life, and that's what ends up really causing them much quicker death than they're on a hospice.
Yes.
So what we do is, if the patient is up, still alive 6 to 8 months into hospice care, we do make the recommendation to the internist and to the family that we would like to discharge them from hospice.
Mm.
The families are usually devastated because, you know, it's a lower level of care when you have to take your loved one to the hospital every time they can't breathe instead of making a phone call to the hospice nurse to come
yes.
in and do an intervention at home.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? So,
Do you think some family members push their dying loved ones or very ill loved ones into hospice care just because it's easier for them?
I wished. We are not there. Hospice has a very bad rep, especially in the state of New Jersey. You have to remember the Dartmouth report from Medicare a few years ago. We are the lowest, we are the number 50 in the state in the overutilization of hospice. We are the most expensive in the last 6 months of life in the whole union.
Why?
In the state of New Jersey.
Why?
The reason is we underutilize hospice. No matter how expensive hospice care is, it is nothing compared to the aggressive care these patients will be getting if they are not on hospice.
Lena, I have to leave it there. Thank you for all of that information and your experience. And Peter Waldman from Bloomberg Businessweek, investigating the idea that some people are being counseled into hospice too early so that the hospices, especially the for-profit ones, can make more money on these relatively healthy people from their Medicare reimbursements. Peter, there's, of course, one really interesting thing that Lena said was that she thought some people actually survive a shorter time if they're not in hospice, because some of the cardiac interventions or whatever actually shorten people's lives rather than extend them. That's, you know, that may be a debate for another day. I just wanted to note what an interesting comment that was. But do you think that some people are actually being told by their doctors that they are closer to death than they really are for the benefit of the hospice's financial bottom line?
There are people out there who that has happened to. According to the investigations and lawsuits that I've been covering, I don't think it's rampant. I don't think it's that widespread. I think when it tends to happen, it's because a patient doesn't have their own doctor, and let's say they're in a nursing home, and believe it or not, there are nursing home doctors who also work for hospices, who also work for for-profit hospices. So they can wear both hats, and there may be a conflict there that has arisen in some of those patient settings. So I don't want to point a finger at doctors as doing this on a very wide-scale basis,
mm-hmm.
but it's definitely come up. And you see situations, let's say there's a specific lawsuit against the hospice, which is owned by a very large company called Gentiva, a for-profit, and one of the ones they bought is called VistaCare. And VistaCare, and it's mostly, I think, in the southern part of the country, VistaCare Hospice has been accused by a whistleblower of doctor shopping, of finding doctors who will certify patients even when their own doctors will not.
Leslie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Leslie.
Yes, hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My mother had Parkinson's, and she was being treated by a neurologist who was also doing Parkinson's research. When she became immobilized, there was concern that she could have a choking episode. She was put in hospice care and was in hospice for about a year and a half.
Hmm.
Basically, a nurse came and checked her once a month. We had no incidents, and they charged $5,500 a month for her care. She was in her own home. We had private attendants that we paid for, but Medicare and the insurance company paid for the hospice care, which I did not know until long after my mother passed away.
So in this case, when you're saying hospice care, you're talking about people who came to your mother's home?
Yes, under hospice, and it was specifically a hospice agency and hospice care. But they charged an enormous amount of money for in our needs for basically a nurse checking her blood pressure and coordinating with the neurologist for her medications.
So your point is that the care was good, and even if it was a year, year and a half, you think it was good for your mother, but it was minimal at $5,500 a month.
It was shocking that they would charge that for one nurse's visit a month, in my opinion.
Peter, have you heard stories like this a lot?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. That's the ideal hospice patient, someone who needs minimal care, but they can bill Medicare on a daily basis. Remember, that $5,500 is because of over $100, $150 a day. That's how they bill, regardless of what they do. So those stories are very common. And the federal government, by the way, looks very closely at those cases and is very concerned about it. That's a very common description.
So, to conclude, this is a minority of people experiencing these negative effects of hospice care, either the overbilling for minimal services or being counseled in when maybe that's not the best thing and more for the purposes of a for-profit hospice's bottom line. What should the individual or the loved one of the sick individual look for to make sure they're doing the right thing before signing up for hospice?
Well, make sure you have a doctor, what's called an attending physician, your own doctor who you trust and respect, and who doesn't have any kind of ulterior motive, who is not connected to a hospice. Let's say many hospices pay these doctors to work one day a week for them. So that's a conflict. But in most cases, that's not the case with doctors. So look for their cue and don't take advice from others. Trust your doctor, particularly when they don't have such a conflict. Don't, for example, take the advice of a nursing home employee, many of whom have very close relationships with the hospices, who troll the nursing homes looking for these kinds of Parkinson's patients and others. The nursing home part of this equation is very, very important right now because hospices come into nursing homes, they find these patients, then they service these patients in the nursing home. So the federal government is paying the daily room and board of the nursing home in addition to the daily service fee of the hospice. So it's a very lucrative area, and the hospice doesn't have to service the patient as much because there are nursing home attendants and others who will. So that's a setting where you have to be highly skeptical and aware of what you're being told.
Peter Waldman, investigating the for-profit hospice industry for Bloomberg Businessweek. You can see his article there. Thank you so much for joining us. Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, the fine art of negotiating your way to yes. Congresspeople and NFL players, this segment is primarily for you. And more of your answers to the question, how hot is it? If you want to submit a So Hot answer, just text So Hot to 30644. Text So Hot to 30644.